High Forest tradition. I was actually talking a little bit about this just the other day with Mark Allen from Sydney Uni. And you have this kind of interesting phenomenon in modern Buddhism where we have these lineages or traditions. Okay, so you have the Thai forest tradition, right? And so that's what we can see. You can go to Thailand, it's actually a contemporary tradition and it's got its own history. We can read books by the masters and blah, blah, blah. Now, then we have also a very long tradition, right, which goes back to the Buddha, the Sangha tradition as such, yeah. But what you were lacking, certainly in Theravada, is very much that sort of in between. The medium tradition is actually very thin in Theravada. So, for example, in the Thai forest tradition, it's not really possible, as far as I know, in a meaningful sense, to trace that back beyond the last part of the 19th century. Okay? So, of course, there are mentions of forest traditions and so on in Thailand previous to that, but we don't really know whether that actually has any particular connection with what we call the forest tradition today. It's just a word, forest tradition. What does it mean? Similarly, in Burma, you have the contemporary Burmese meditation schools, Mahasi and so on, and I think that it was Venerable Nyana Ponika, one of the very senior German monks who I think maybe in the 1950s or something went to Burma and did meditation there, and he sort of made inquiries and tried to do some research as well. What's the history and the lineage of this teaching? And he could really only take it back a generation or two, to maybe the generation of, say, Ledi Sayadaw, who was around the turn of the century. And so it seems that there's not really any particular historical evidence for these kind of meditation lineages as being much older than that. And in fact, it's quite possible, and as I was discussing with Mark, is that the reason there's no evidence for them is because there weren't any. And the modern meditation movements, in fact, stem largely from the modernist reforms in Buddhism that happened around the middle of the 19th century. And so, which is actually a post-colonial movement. So with the colonial movement, you have this thing what they call Protestant Buddhism, which basically means go back and read the original texts, okay? Just as the Protestant movement in Europe said, well, let's go back and read the Bible and not necessarily believe what the church is telling us, yeah? And so what they call Protestant Buddhism, it's a bit of a slogan in academic circles, it says, well, let's not look at what Buddhism is, but let's look at what the Buddhist texts say, the original Buddhist texts in the Pali Canon. Read them. They tell you how to meditate, that you should be meditating and how to meditate. Let's go and do that. Yeah? And so it seems to me that there's fairly likely that actually the modern meditation traditions really stem from, or largely at least, from that kind of process rather than from necessarily a sort of an ancient continual meditation lineage. Which is not to say that there's not a that there wasn't a lineage and that didn't have influence, but I think that the very large part of the influence is like a modern reform movement. Now in Thailand, what happened was that in the middle of the 19th century, you had the reforms introduced by Prince Mongkut. Yeah, so you probably know Prince Mongkut from The King and I. Yeah, Yul Brynner in The King and I. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, I think so, yeah. And he, before he became king, he was a monk. And he wrote some very interesting books, actually, and did some very interesting research, and his biography is quite interesting, quite inspiring. But he essentially ordained as a young man. He was obviously very brilliant, had a very brilliant mind, and a very critical mind, and a very incisive kind of thinker. But he ordained, and after his first ordained, he went to practice at this meditation monastery outside of Bangkok. And they said, do this, do that. This is how you meditate. And when he asked them questions, why do you do it like this? What is this? They couldn't answer his questions. Okay? And he became very disillusioned because he felt that they were just sort of doing things by rote, just sort of, just this mechanical process. There didn't seem to be any depth of actual authenticity or experience in what he found. So he left that place, came back to Bangkok and sort of went on an exploration of the Pali texts and became a very good Pali scholar. And so that was his, and on that basis formed the kind of the modern structure of the Thai Sangha. And then in the next generation after him came along a fellow called Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Mun hailed from Ubon Ratchathani in the northeast of Thailand. He was born, I think, 1890 or something like that, in the 1890s. And, of course, in those days, the northeast Thailand region was very, very poor, very backwards and undeveloped. Still very primitive and simple villages in that area. If you're interested in to look at a depiction of that region in those times, there's actually one of the most an interesting cultural artifact from that region is a film called Chang. Chang being the local word for elephant, and this black and white silent film made in the 1920s by the fellow who then went on to make the first King Kong. I don't remember his name, but the director of King Kong before that made a movie called Chang, set in northeast Thailand, about the northeast Thailand villages. Yeah, and a similar kind of theme about the kind of the monster from the forest who was threatening the fragile settlements and how they had to defend themselves against the threats from the jungle. So but that gives you an idea of how tenuous life was in those days. So Ajahn Mun had a friend whose name was Upali. Now Upali, there's various kinds of stories of their adventures when they were young and so on. Ajahn Mun was an expert in what they call Mor Lum. But this is before he was Ajahn Mun, when he was just a kid. Mor Lum. Mor Lum is the local form of folk music, and it's like a kind of it's a bit like a kind of an old blues thing or something, but it has like a rhythmic kind of beat, and then improvised dialogue over the rhythm. And typically, the improvised dialogue would be a man and a woman. So you'd have this kind of whole backing and forthing thing going on, and they would use lots of poetry and plays with words and innuendos and all of these kinds of things. So it was a very popular art form in those days, a folk art form, and Ajahn Mun was very clever with that. He's very, very sharp mind and very good with words and so on. So he used to, it was one of the things he used to do. So he ordained, and like most men in Thailand in those days would take temporary ordination. Of course, opportunities for ordination for women were slender or non-existent. He ordained in some local village monastery, I think. It's been a long time since I've brushed up on all the details of these things, but he came in contact with some meditation monks and became more interested in the meditation side of things, the meditation aspect, and wanted to travel around and do that. He switched, after his ordination, he switched his ordination lineage to what they call the Dhammayut sect. So in Thailand, what was forming in those decades, or had already formed, was an idea of having two separate Nikayas, what they call the Mahanikaya and the Dhammayut. Dhammayut was the reform sect originated by Prince Mongkut, okay, based on a Burmese ordination lineage, right? And it was and remains a very small minority. About 5% of Thai monks are in the Dhammayut Nikaya. The Dhammayut Nikaya, you know, for those of us in Australia, what happened is that the Thai, they sat down, the two sects sat down, and they got a map of the world and appointed one or other of the sect to each country, and Australia got Dhamma Ute, right? So the local Thai monks who you see in Sydney are Dhamma Ute monks, okay? So they're from that reform sect. The Jalkun Samai and the Annandale Temple and these places is from a Dhamma Ute. It's predominantly in Australia. The rest of Thailand, the rest of Thai Sangha, is what they call Mahanikai. Now, Mahanikai really is not a sect as such, but it's really just what's left over. And they didn't really have a sense of being a unified sect or grouping, except it formed in opposition or in contrast to the Dhamma Ute. Yeah? So that's about 90 or 95% of the monks in Thailand. So typically, the idea was that the Mahanikai monks were slack, okay? So we've just been reading the article just now about wearing lipstick and carrying handbags and these kinds of things. So that's the Mahanikai kind of style, yeah? Not so hung up, you know, not so uptight about things, you know, a little bit of wearing a handbag is not such a problem. Bit of lipstick, never mind. So that's the kind of the Mahanikai was much more culturally based. They would do things like the rituals and ceremonies for the villagers. They would do lots of kind of Brahmanical style rituals. They would do things like they would give, say, very colourful sermons in local dialects and so on. So that would be almost like I mentioned, Ajahn Mun was doing the more Lam folk style singing. So they would do stuff like that, and they would tell the ancient stories in a very dramatic style where they'd kind of imitate all the voices of the characters and these kinds of things. So they'd be almost like putting on plays for people. These kind of folk arts and traditions which were carried out in the monasteries around Thailand. The Dhamma Ute sect was much more serious, right? And they're Pali Canon, Four Noble Truths, Keeping Vinaya, yeah? And it was all a bit more kind of serious and stern. It was also mixed up with the whole notion of the creation of Thailand as a nation state in the colonial era. Yeah, so ensuring the stability and coherence of the Thai nation state under threat from colonial powers. So the Dhamma Ute movement was trying to unify nationalist movement to try to unify Thailand. So typically what happened is that a lot of the monks in the forest tradition, including Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, and many others, they would just ordain in their local village temple, which would usually be a Mahanikai temple. Then after a while, they started to learn a bit, got a bit of knowledge. They realized they wanted to sharpen up their Vinaya practice, get a bit more serious about things, and so they wanted to convert to Dhamma Ute. So Ajahn Mun did that. And I mentioned before his friend Upali, became a monk. But Upali followed a different career course, and he ended up going to Bangkok and becoming a very respected academic study monk in Bangkok. And he became Jalkun Upali, who's a very well-known and very respected figure from that era. But he retained his friendship with Ajahn Mun in that time. So, you know, so you have, almost have these kind of two career choices as the forest monk or the study monk. And there's these two friends who ended up doing that. But both of them, as part of that Dhamma Ute movement, which was that kind of reform movement. Yeah? Now, despite the fact that Ajahn Mun joined this Dhamma Ute movement, he didn't. That doesn't mean that he accepted or embraced everything which they stood for. On the contrary, one of the controversial or questionable aspects of the Dhamma Ute when it was formed was that it seems that a lot of the people, including perhaps Prince Mongkut himself, believed that Nibbana was unattainable in this present age. Right? That we live in a degenerate times and it's not possible to realize the various stages of enlightenment. Yeah? And this idea was very, very widespread. And part of the Dhamma Ute movement had been much more focused on, well, we can't get enlightened, so let's focus on encouraging people to do dana and keep their precepts and study the Dhamma. These are the things we can actually do, and really, you know, trying to meditate to get enlightened is a bit of a waste of time. Okay? And a lot of people believed this kind of thing and still do. So Ajahn Mun, when he ordained, had been told these kinds of things, and he didn't really know whether this was true or not. Okay? And this is one of the themes that comes out in his biography. And he had to test that. So he joined the Dhammayut, and you know, the certain aspects of that were very supportive for him. The good vinaya practice was supportive, the sort of the coming back to the central teachings, the Four Noble Truths and so on. These were all very supportive. Other things he introduced, innovations like, say, keeping the Dutanga practices, yeah, just wearing one set of three robes, eating one time a day, going for alms and just eating his alms, food that he got in his alms bowl. These were innovations in those times, yeah, and he would be criticized for it. Yeah. So one time he was at a big ceremony or something like that, and he was eating out of his alms bowl, and the other monks were criticizing him, saying, "How can you eat out of your bowl? That's so uncivilized. You know, there's all these important people here. Yeah, how can you be eating out of your bowl? You know, with just your fingers?" And then he said, "Well, how can you eat off plates with the Buddha here?" And pointed to the Buddha image. Yeah, how could you sit with the Buddha watching you and then eat off a plate and not use your bowl? So this was Ajahn Mun's way of practice. He's very much in the Mahakasapa school, the kind of the ascetic, stern kind of thing. You see his photographs, he looks really grim in his photos. But that has to be taken also with a bit of a grain of salt, because at that time in Thailand, it's actually quite, you didn't smile in photographs, it wasn't the done thing. Also, it was socially not yet really acceptable for monks to have their photos taken. It was a kind of a bit of a, because it was a kind of a vanity thing. So apparently he didn't really like having his photo taken. He had to be forced to do it, so he was a bit grumpy. And you also see that he's very skinny, yeah, in the photograph. And you think, wow, he's really emaciated, yeah. But that also, if you go to northeast Thailand, even today, you see, you know, the old guys there, they're all like that. You know, the diet is just not very good. They smoke. Ajahn Mun, I think, smoked, and probably chewed betel nut, and have one meal a day. So yeah, he looks pretty skinny, but it's not as drastic as it might appear. Yeah, it's in the Vinaya. Yeah. So, but. So some of those things are more kind of recommended practices or extra practices. So for example, eating one meal a day. And the Buddha said, well, look, I eat one meal a day, it's good. He said, if you want to have two meals a day, that's fine. But it's more like an optional extra to do the one meal a day thing, yeah. No, it's allowed to smoke in the Vinaya. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, are you allowed to smoke? But the question is that there wasn't any tobacco in the time of the Buddha. So then people are asking, well, what were they smoking? Yeah. And did it help their meditation? Yeah. Yeah, there is a thing. It's actually part of Ayurvedic medicine that certain herbs are smoked. Yeah. Yeah. And also remember that 100 years ago and so on, they didn't know that there was a health risk with smoking and things like that. It was just kind of something that people did. So he, Ajahn Mun, then pursued this practice, went off to the forest to try to meditate. There was a circle of monks who would meet around and mix, and they would learn from. And one particular monk, Ajahn Sao, was his teacher in that period. And so he learnt a lot about meditation and so on from Ajahn Sao. And in that period, he discovered or developed those things which have remained very much the core practices of the forest tradition, which means... So the essence of the forest tradition in terms of lifestyle is keeping a very strict vinaya, living in a secluded place in the forest, an emphasis on simplicity, having a simple heart or something like that. The wandering lifestyle that they call tudong, wandering from village to village. These days it's much more difficult to do because of the pace of development. You can't really wander around so much. In those days you would be wandering along a jungle track from one village to the next. These days it's walking along a highway in the sweltering sun with trucks thundering past you, so it's not so conducive. A focus on the a simple, sort of very direct and authentic application of the core central Buddhist teachings. Okay, so not so much into the whole sort of scholastic philosophical side, but let's take the Four Noble Truths, let's take the Eightfold Path, impermanent suffering, not self. Let's take those central teachings, apply them, and it's all about the authenticity and the integrity and the power with which you apply those teachings, which is the important thing. And the central, which is not to say that Ajahn Mun and so on weren't kind of learners. And I've heard that, I'm not sure how true it is, but I heard that Ajahn Mun used to carry around a copy of the Abhidhammatthasangaha on his tudong, which is an 11th century Burmese compendium of the Abhidhamma. So it's quite a slim volume. They certainly were critical of, Ajahn Mun was critical of approaches to Dhamma that was like purely scholastic and which sort of didn't believe in the experiential side. But remember that the context that he'd come from, where people literally didn't believe. You know, it's hard to sort of get your head around this. You know? So we've approached Buddhism as, you know, meditation's the first thing we find about Buddhism. But that's really not how it is. Yeah, I've heard Ajahn Mahabua, one of Ajahn Mun's students, talking in his Dhamma talk, and he spent 3 years in Bangkok, studying in Bangkok, before he went to the forest to find Ajahn Mun. And while he was practicing there, he used to study with the other monks and then go off and do his meditation. And the other monks would laugh at him. Yeah, they'd make fun of him. Yeah, oh, Buddha, you're going to go off and tell us, you're going to go to Nibbana, are you going to go to heaven? Oh, well, tell us what it's like when you get to Nibbana, will you? Come back and let us know. And so they were having jokes at him and laughing at him because he was diligent in his practice. You know, that's how alienated, yeah, much of the Sangha has become from the actual practice of meditation. And that remains the same today. So Ajahn Mun, and then developed the central meditation practices of the forest tradition. One is the recollection of the word buddho. Yeah? So they use buddho as a mantra, either just using it as a meditation word by itself or else connecting it with the breath. So buddho, buddho with the breath. Or doing it while walking meditation. So that was one particular meditation. Second one was body investigation. So looking at the parts of the body, looking at the elements. The Thai forest tradition is very much a body-based meditation system. A very strong emphasis on mindfulness of the body. There are very cemetery contemplations. They very often would go to the cemeteries and be with decaying bodies. Or just investigating the images of their own body and so on in various ways. That's a very strong part. Breath meditation of Anapanasati, another very strong part of the Thai forest tradition. And they also emphasize a lot on walking meditation. And some of the Thai forest masters will do mostly walking meditation and fairly short amount of time sitting. Yeah? And of course, this is in addition to the wandering that they would do. So very often you're walking for many, many hours every day. So that's a very strong emphasis. So these are the kinds of meditations which Ajahn Mun was developing. Now, he had as a guide and a friend this other monk, Ajahn Sao, during this period. And but there came a point where he actually surpassed his teacher. And there came a point where he had a nimitta or an experience in his meditation where he actually he came up against a wall in his progress. His meditation became very deep, very profound, but he couldn't develop any further. And then he realized or understood that he had made a bodhisattva vow in his past life, that he had made a vow to become a Buddha, and that because of that, that he couldn't realize enlightenment in this lifetime, that this was an obstruction for him. So he renounced his bodhisattva vow. Yeah? He was so determined to realize full enlightenment in this very life, that he renounced this vow which he'd made in past lives, which was obstructing his progress. So this is also interesting. I won't comment on that one, but we wouldn't be here if you hadn't. Yeah, I mean, there's different ways of looking at that and different ways of interpreting it. Yeah, but anyway, that's just the story. So once he'd renounced that vow, then he practiced and eventually attained full enlightenment or arahantship. After he'd surpassed his teacher Ajahn Sao, he spent the rains retreat with him, and during that rains retreat, because Ajahn Sao was senior to him, he spent the rains retreat doing all the services for his teacher, and then after they'd been in there for a month or two, then he sort of very kind of gently kind of broke the news to him, oh, by the way, this is where I've got. And then after that time, then Ajahn Sao became his student. And then he led, and eventually Ajahn Sao also became enlightened. While he was practicing, there's many, many stories. Ajahn Mun's biography is around the place, so there's many stories of his practice in caves and his encounters with all kinds of beings and spirits and all of these kinds of things, which you can read in his biography. One time he was staying in a monastery in Chiang Mai, and while he was there, he was asked to become the abbot of the monastery. At that time, he was, apparently they say here at that time, he was an anagami, non-returner, and he was asked to become the abbot of the monastery, and then he said, "Ah, oh, I'm not going to waste my time here." So he climbed out of the window in the middle of the night and ran back to the forest to stay in a cave and finish his work. Yeah. So, yeah, very, very strong practice. Very strong for his ascetic practices and his dedication to seclusion. When I was in northern Thailand a number of years ago, I met a monk called Ajahn, another grumpy old monk called Ajahn Khan, in Chiang Rai. And Ajahn Khan had been practiced with Ajahn Mun, and so that generation, like when I was in Thailand in the 90s, that was really the time when there was the last few of Ajahn Mun's direct disciples were still alive. The only one, or the only prominent one, who's still alive now is Ajahn Mahabua. Ajahn Khan said that he used to, when they were practicing in around the Chiang Mai region, there was like three or four of them, and they used to practice on hilltops, so on different hills. So they had a separate, each of the monks would stay on a separate hill, and every week on the Uposatha day, on the Poya day, the small one, each week they would hold up a lantern so that they'd know that the other, and they could see, so that they'd know that the other ones were still alive. And then on the fortnight, on the Uposatha day, they'd get together to do the Parimokkha. Yeah. And then the rest of the time they just spent staying by themselves and doing the meditation. So that was their lifestyle. After living in northern Thailand for several years, then Ajahn Mun came back to northeast Thailand and eventually settled down and started a monastery. It was kind of interesting as to why he chose this particular village to start his monastery in, and it was a pretty, very kind of poor, backwards village. The weather was really bad. The piece of land that the monastery started on wasn't very good, and people really didn't understand why he sort of settled there. You know, places in the north of Thailand and that much more beautiful and much more better weather and all these kinds of things. But it seems that the reason why he stayed there was because, one theory that I've heard of why he stayed there was because in the local village was a woman meditator who was a very strong meditator, and he wanted to stay on and guide her. And if I have got my story right, and again, I haven't read this for a number of years, but if I got my story right, she was the lady later known as Meiqi Gao, whose biography has just been translated into English, and we've got a soft copy of it at Santi. So if anyone's interested, the story of Meiqi Gao is around. But she evidently also became an arahant under Ajahn Mun's guidance, a very talented meditator. So he stayed there at that time, had got a very strong circle of disciples, and that time, of course, the forest tradition was still very small, and very much kind of marginal in Thai Buddhism. But Ajahn Mun had a knack of sort of gathering to him a small but extremely sort of talented group of meditators, many of whom went on to become great meditation masters in their own right. And among them were Ajahn Kao, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Bua is another one, Lumpu Te, and quite a few others. So probably the best known of his disciples from that period was Ajahn Mahabua, who spent about a number of years, maybe 5 years or more, with Ajahn Mun, and has been his main interpreter. So the Ajahn Mun that we see is largely Ajahn Mun through Ajahn Mahabua's eyes, and so that's important to remember in his biography. Other people see a different side of him, and even though Ajahn Mun has his reputation for being very tough and so on, but Ajahn Mahabua has got some very delightful stories of, say, a time when he was doing this ascetic practice where he would only accept the alms that was given to him in the village, right? So remember, you'd go into the village, you'd get some sticky rice, a banana, maybe a cookie or something like that, and you'd bring that back and you'd eat it. It wouldn't be very much, maybe a bit of chili or something. And so he wouldn't accept any of the food that was cooked or prepared in the monastery, so only what was actually offered by the villagers. And this is similar to the practices that Mahakasapa would keep. So no one would actually allow to put any food in his bowl, yeah? Except he said that Ajahn Mun would always find some way of distracting him and pulling away his attention and then sneaking something into his bowl while he wasn't looking, yeah? So he used to always kind of do this to do that. So it's so like another side to Ajahn Mun that I don't think he was so stern and fierce all the time. So from this circle of students of Ajahn Mun, many of them set up their own monasteries after Ajahn Mun passed away. I can't remember the day, I think it was 1949 or in the 1950s or something like that he died. And many of his disciples then set up their own monasteries and became great teachers in their own right. One of the students of Ajahn Mun was Ajahn Chah, who's of course the founder of the lineage that I ordained in. And Ajahn Chah's story was a little bit, or in some ways similar to that of Ajahn Mun. He ordained originally in this village monastery near Ubon Ratchathani, came from the same town as Ajahn Mun. After a few years, became interested in the forest lifestyle and meditation lifestyle. He left that village, travelled around, stayed with different teachers, and learnt a little bit from each teacher, although he didn't have like one main teacher who he studied and practiced with. Ajahn Chah went and stayed with Ajahn Mahabua. And there was one well-known occasion where he stayed for just a few days when he was quite a young monk. And he always said that even though he only spent a very short time with Ajahn Mun, that was a really crucial time for him, that he answered some questions which were very critical for his meditation practice. One of the things that he asked him, because Ajahn Chah ordained in the Mahanikaya tradition, one of the things he asked him is, I'd like to reordain as a Dhammayut monk. And Ajahn Mun said, no, there's no need. Yeah? You stay in Mahanikaya. Mahanikaya needs good monks as well. So this was kind of interesting because it is a political thing between the Dhammayut and the Mahanikaya. as to which has power and influence and so on. And normally, if you're with a Dhammayut teacher and there was obviously a very talented student who wants to come along and ordain, normally they'd be, oh, great, you know, it's terrific, come with us. Yeah. And so this is... sometimes the Dhammayut goes so far as to suggest that the Mahanikaya monks are not actually monks, right? So they say that the standards of Vinaya and the tradition were so bad that there's no authentic ordination lineage in the rest of Thailand. So this is sometimes suggested that actually only the Dhammayut bhikkhus are actually ordained, the rest of us are novices. Yeah? And this is taken quite seriously. If I go and stay in Dhammayut monasteries, they won't let you in to recite the Parimokkha together, for example. So this kind of shows that Ajahn Mun had a very different attitude towards this question. So some of the, I think at least two of the questions that Ajahn Chah asked Ajahn Mun about, one was about Vinaya practice. And he said that he'd been studying Vinaya very carefully. Ajahn Chah did a lot of very, very deep, very detailed study of Vinaya and was very sincere about trying to practice everything as best he could. And he said, you know, basically he said to Ajahn Mun, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he said, basically, it's just a headache, you know. You're trying to study, do all of these things, and you can never be sure if, you know, you've got everything right, and so on and so forth. And so Ajahn Mun emphasized to him that at the base of it lies your intention, yeah? And so we try to do the best we can in our study, in our practice, it's the intention underlying it which is the decisive factor in the end, not whether you've necessarily got every detail right. So if this is getting a bit noisy, then you can come up closer if you want, if you can't hear. So the other question which Ajahn Chah asked Ajahn Mun, I'm just trying to remember it now, but I'm a bit rusty, but it was a much more interesting question. It was about meditation and about the how to use his mind in meditation. And I have to admit I've forgotten what the exact question was. Maybe that will come to me later. Any case, so this was this encounter between Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah. So later on, of course, Ajahn Chah set up his own monastery in Ubon Ratchathani. So when he set up his monastery, just as Ajahn Mun had reformed, had taken on some aspects of the Dhammayut tradition and had criticized some and reformed some, similarly Ajahn Chah took up the Dhammayut forest tradition that he'd had experience with and reformed and changed certain things. The main thing that Ajahn Chah changed was he moved the emphasis back from the teacher, from the guru, to the sangha, to the community. Yeah? Now, in the Dhammayut circles, we had evolved a very, very kind of teacher-centric system or guru-centric system. So you had the very charismatic teachers like Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Kao, and so on. And they would, a group of disciples would come around them, practice, and usually when the teacher died, everything would fall apart. Yeah? And this is kind of pattern, and this has happened in just about every monastery. The teacher died, everything fell apart. Yeah? And things were too dependent on the teacher. I mean, the advantage of that... So, for example, you see one characteristic, say, Ajahn Mahabua, has a number of Western disciples, Western monks who are his disciples there, yeah? And they're all still there, okay? And they ordained, some of them ordained, the oldest one ordained, I think, in the 1960s, right? And he died in the same monastery about 3 or 4 years ago, okay? So they went there, Ajahn Mahabua said, you don't go anywhere, you stay with me, right? And they stayed there. And they didn't go anywhere, and the only place that they go to is to go down to Bangkok once a year to do their visa, or something like that, and that's basically it. So that's Ajahn Mahabua's style. Yeah? Now, what that means, of course, is that you can support a close group of disciples, yeah, for many years, and so they had that stability and support and so on. But it also means that, well, none of you have heard of any of those monks. You haven't been taught by them, yeah? And we haven't had the benefit of the teachings from those monks. Why? Because they're still back there in their monastery there. Ajahn Chah had a very different approach, and he would tell his young monks and young disciples to get up on the seat and give a Dhamma talk, even though they'd been only ordained for a couple of years. Right? And so he would make them do that. He would make them go and start monasteries. He would make them leave where he was. There, don't stay with me. You know, you don't get attached to your teacher. Go out and start your own place. And he instigated a system of, I'm going to say a call what, or a monastery protocol and guidelines and so on, which could be implemented in different systems, like a bit like a franchise kind of system, yeah? So you got this kind of thing in places. So, and what that meant is that supported by that system and by that protocol, it wasn't so dependent on a charismatic teacher. Yeah? So, of course, there have been some great meditation masters have come up through the Ajahn Chah tradition, but there are many, many monasteries now. The Ajahn Chah tradition has well over 300 monasteries, well over 1,000. I mean, even when I was there was more than 1,000 monks. Ajahn Chah was stopped teaching in the early 80s. He went into a coma for many years, and he passed away in 1992. So he effectively hasn't been teaching since the early or mid-80s. Okay, so that's a long time. And yet the Ajahn Chah tradition is still very strong. Okay, so there's still, you know, I think there's maybe 2,000 monks or something like that in the Ajahn Chah tradition, maybe 500 Meichi, and you know, certainly over 200 or 300 monasteries, as well as many branch monasteries overseas. How long was he in a coma? Nearly 10 years, I think. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure of all the details of the history, but I think he probably came in and out of it a bit in the earlier years and sort of, you know, more sort of slipped deeply into it in later times. Yeah. So, of course, there's various stories about that, you see, because when he was in the coma, he would be looked after, and you know, when you're in a coma, you're never completely still. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody who's in a coma in the hospital, but they usually have some kind of movement or something like that. There's some slight bodily tremors or something like that, and just like someone who's sleeping, and then they kind of move from time to time or something. But Ajahn Chah would go completely still for periods of time. One time, the king and the queen sent down a message. This was a really important monk to the local hospital. They sent down a message. It's a really important monk. You've got to look after him. So they sent this very kind of nervous young nurse in there to look after him. And this male nurse who was looking after Ajahn Chah was like, you know, don't die on my shift, you know. And and so he did this kind of thing where he just went completely still. And Ajahn Chah was a monk who was also attending there, and he said, oh, don't worry, he's just meditating. And so he was starting to panic, and he was like testing his you know, he wasn't any breathing. There was nothing, no signs of life. It was completely still. Yeah, but his why? Because his body temperature didn't change. Yeah, and they literally couldn't test any breathing for several hours. Yeah, except his blood oxygen level stayed the same, and then he just sort of came out of, after a period of time. So there's obviously something going on there. And then of course there's many stories about this one story, for example. Well, this is a kind of interesting story that when he was in a coma, this lady who was a psychic in Perth went to visit the monastery in Bodhnyana, and she drove up there. She'd never been to a Buddhist monastery before. She arrived at the front gates, and she parked outside the front gates, and she wasn't sure whether she should go in. She was quite nervous about going in. And this monk came to her and said, oh, you know, and just sort of waved her in. He said, go inside, this Thai monk. So she went inside the monastery, and she went up and see where Ajahn Brahma and Ajahn Jagaro was. And she said, where's that nice monk who showed me in? She could see all the monks sitting there. Where's that nice monk who showed me into the monastery? They said, which monk? She said, it's like this Thai monk or something. They said, no, we don't have any Thai monks staying here. And she saw a photo of Ajahn Chah on the shrine. She said, that's him. He was the one. He was the one who showed me in. Yeah. So he's still hanging around. And she said that, the interesting thing was, she said he stays, he has a kuti over there. And she pointed to a part of the forest. And she said he stays over there in this little hut. Yeah. I don't know why he's staying in a little hut. But anyway, she said he stays in a little hut over there. But the interesting thing, which is just behind where the women's section now is, and it was subsequently built there. And sometime later, a Thai monk who didn't know anything about this story visited, and he had also very good psychic powers, and he said the same thing. He said, Ajahn Chah's got a little kuti over in the forest and pointed to the same place and said, this is where he comes and stays just to look after everyone, make sure they're all okay. Yeah? So anyway, I'm just telling you the stories. So this is the... Sorry? He's still in a coma then, he wasn't dead. Yeah? Oh, yeah, he's obviously, yeah, most people say he was an arahant, yeah. He was not dead yet, he was in a coma. Nietzsche? Oh, really? Oh, well, there you go. I don't know what could have been going on. Yeah? But certainly, you know, there's a lot of people in comas have normal brain activity. Yeah. So, that's the Ajahn Chah tradition. What was I going to say about that? I'm not sure of the medical details about it. Yeah, it was just a kind of a gradual degenerative process. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know the medical details. Yeah. So, Thai forest tradition. So I should just to sort of wrap it up or bring it up to date, I guess. But the I mentioned before, just briefly in passing, that the king and the queen of Thailand had sort of sent a message to the Ubon Hospital. Now that's very characteristic of what had happened to the forest tradition. During the 1960s and 70s, the Thai royal family started to take an interest in the forest tradition and started to visit them. And of course this caused a great shift in the whole perception of everything. So the forest monks, rather than being seen as these kind of semi-tramps wearing these dirty robes and living in these, you know, disgusting little huts in the middle of the primitive jungle, right? Oh, suddenly the king and queen are going there. What's going on, you know? And word started to spread around in Bangkok society. Oh, these are arahants, okay? And then they started to realize, well, there's this kind of authenticity to practice. And they could sort of contrast that with what was going on with the city monks and so on. And, of course, you hear various kind of stories about, you know, what happened when they went to visit, like the Lumpur Chop. Apparently, when the queen came to visit Lumpur Chop for the first time, she visited, they chatted for a while, and then she left. And Lumpur Chop was a very kind of simple kind of village kind of monk. He's very, very, you know, adept meditator, but a very simple man. And after he left, he said to the other monk who was there, he said, she was a nice lady. Who was that? I said, but that was Her Royal Majesty, because in Thai they've got these incredibly highfalutin words for all the royal family, you see. So that was her Royal Majesty. He's like, what? It was Her Highness, the Queen. What do you mean? Oh, it was the King's old lady. Oh, okay. The King's missus. Oh, okay. And all these kind of stories of how that happened. Apparently, another time when the King and Queen visited Lumpur Chop, and again, I'm just repeating stories that I've heard, but apparently that he used to do this thing with small teapot and big teacups, right? So you sit around with a few people drinking tea, and he was serving tea to the king and queen, and they were chatting, and they'd have fairly large cups and a very small teapot, and then he'd keep on refilling all the cups from the same teapot, you see. These are the kind of little tricks that they have. Yeah. So, it's actually like in the forest tradition, there's like one side of it is this very kind of austere thing and very strict and so on. But another side is that there's a lot of very, very colourful characters, very, very playful, very colourful stories and so on that they have. And, wicked senses of humour and so on. And so they had this way of being very, very direct and in their teaching sometimes. Just one example I can give you is a monk called Rinpo De, who was renowned as being perhaps the most grumpy of all the forest monks, and also regarded as being a grumpy arahant. But he was one time giving a talk in this big sala. It was the first time the forest tradition, Ajahn Lee, had built this big sala in Wat Lasokaram near Bangkok. Big hall, and he was giving a Dhamma talk, and it was one of the first times when they actually had a PA. Right, so they had a microphone and a PA and all these, and there's hundreds of people there chatting and making a big racket, and he gets on the Dhamma talk and everyone ignores him, right? So he gets ready to give a talk, he's on the Dhamma seat, everyone ignores him, and he just looks around and no one's paying any attention or anything, so he gets the microphone, puts it under his lower robe and does a big fart. And there's deathly silence through the whole place, yeah? Everything just stops. He says, yeah, that's right, you listen to a monk fart, but you won't listen to him talk about Dhamma. That's it. And then he gets off and it's his Dhamma talk. Yeah. So this is a forest tradition teaching, you know, and they always want to teach with very practical ways. Another one, Ajahn Lee, one time was going to teach a retreat and met this group of lay people. They're all going to go out to the monastery to teach a retreat, and he sees them, and they've come, and they've all got these big suitcases full of stuff. And he looks at it, and he says, these people haven't come here to renounce anything. So they're at the train station, and he just gets his bowl and robes and just starts walking down the train tracks. Yeah? And so they just had to follow him. Yeah? He wasn't waiting for them, so they just had to pick up all their big suitcases and everything and walk down the train lines, yeah? And as they go on, they're getting exhausted and their hands getting sore and everything, and then they just start taking all this junk out and throwing it away. And they just threw out all their stuff out of their suitcases gradually, and when he saw that they'd thrown enough stuff away, he said, okay, that's all right. So then they caught the train the rest of the way. So, again, this is a forest tradition style. So these, after the king and queen paid attention to them, the Bangkok elite started paying attention to them, then of course that's, in a way, that's the beginning or the beginning of the end, depending on how you want to see it. Yeah? And so of course these days the forest tradition is very relatively large in Thailand, quite wealthy. They've got very big monasteries, so this becomes very political. In the old days, you'd go out to the jungle, the villagers would say, here you go, there's a bit of wilderness, you make a jungle, you make a monastery there. It's just forest, no one's interested in it, yeah? Well, 50 years later, there's a city there, yeah? There's suburbs all around, and that's valuable real estate, yeah? So this becomes then a very political thing. So there's a possession of land, status of the forest tradition, the way that they're revered, then becomes a source of political tension, and so on. So we don't want to go too much into the politics of it, but it does have that dimension to it which can't be ignored. But certainly it remains the case that in Thailand the forest tradition is still very strong and still a lot of very wonderful forest monasteries. Everywhere you go you can find them. They're not the ones that are listed in the tourist brochures and so on, but the ones that you can stumble across by various kinds of means. And and in those places you'll see the monks sort of living very simple life and practicing meditation and so on. So it's still alive, even though it has been through a lot of struggles and a lot of difficulties, but still.
According to your story, in the Thai tradition, there are two branches, the
Mahanikaya and the Dhammayut, yeah. That's in the Thai Sangha generally. Mahanikaya. So Ajahn Chah was from the Mahanikaya tradition. So you have this like formal distinction of, you know, the Dhammayutta here and then the Mahanikaya here. Forest tradition is part of both of them. There was actually a proposal a few years ago, Ajahn Mahabua made the proposal to form a third forest sect. Yeah? Because actually the forest monks in the Dhammayutta Mahanikaya probably have more in common with each other than they do with the city monks in either sect. But that never got any traction. Yeah. And they, generally speaking, they tend to, those circles tend to move around together, mix together quite a lot. Yeah. They're from the Dhammayutta, and they're from the main basis of the Thai monks in Sydney is from Wat Asoka Ram, which was started originally by Ajahn Lee, who was one of Ajahn Mun's disciples. So that's, but Wat Asoka Ram itself is a large monastery which is not far from Bangkok. So again, one of these places originally started as a forest monastery, but now has become, it's not really a forest monastery these days. But still is kind of the Bangkok centre for the Dhammayutta forest tradition, really, is at Wat Asoka Ram. So the Thai monasteries, the Thai monasteries in Australia, certainly in Adelaide, Canberra, and Sydney, also Townsville, Darwin, a few other places, as well as the ones in Indonesia, are established from that circle. Whereas, for example, the monks in Malaysia are not. That's completely different.
That's
right, yeah. The Thai Sangha is formally administered by a body called the Council of Elders, Mahathera Samakom. That body is established under the Thai Sangha Act of 1962. Now, the Thai Sangha Act is an act of parliament. The first Sangha Act was about 1901 or something like that. So it's actually like a formal kind of Western style legal instrument that defines what is Sangha and what is not, and sets up a bureaucracy, an administration, a set of titles, powers, responsibilities, and so on, which is supposed to administer the Sangha in Thailand. One of the main agendas of the Sangha Act, of course, is to ensure that the Thai Sangha acts as a force to support the Thai national interest. That's really the purpose of having the Thai Sangha Act. In 1962, for example, there was a strong communist insurrection in a lot of parts of Thailand and a military dictatorship in Bangkok. So the aim of the military government was to ensure that you didn't have like revolutionary monks who were out there supporting the rebels. Okay, so this is kind of the political agenda that's driving that thing. The Sangha Act is fairly ineffectual, doesn't really do much. The Mahathera Samakom, the Council of Elders, most of them are pretty derelict. They're kind of they're in hospital a lot of the time. They barely functions as an operative body. So the administration is sort of handled more by the kind of mid-level administrative monks. And so this is one of the problems, is that even though the social conditions under which the Thai Sangha Act was set up have changed dramatically. I mean, Thailand's not a military dictatorship anymore, or at least it's not this week. I don't know about next week. And the social conditions have changed a lot, but the Thai Sangha structure hasn't followed that. Many attempts at reform, but none of them have worked. They haven't been able to find the unity and the leadership to be able to follow it through. Yeah. So they do have these titles. Ajahn Brahm was given a title. Usually the titles are things which, if you're in the administrative career path of a monk, is really coveted, it's really competitive, and you have to sort of work really hard and do a lot of stuff to actually get the title. Once you've got it, of course, there's a lot of privileges that come with it. In Ajahn Brahm's case, there was like a special king's birthday. I think it was like the king's 72nd birthday or something like that. And so they sort of gave a number of titles as like a special thing. And Ajahn Brahm was recommended by his preceptor, Somdet Puttacharn, So even though he's not sort of formally part of the administrative structure or anything, but he was just sort of given the title as a special like recognition of his work in establishing Buddhism overseas. Ajahn Sumedho is also a Jakun, yeah. Not formally, no. They did meet, actually. Ajahn Chah and Mahasi met in England one time. There's a similar origin, as I was saying, talking about the origins of the tradition, that it sort of came out of a kind of a modernist reform, yeah, rejecting the kind of traditional idea that you can't get enlightenment, and coming back to an emphasis on meditation and specifically on the actual meditations that are taught in the Pali Canon, remembering that a lot of what would have gone under the name of meditation in those countries, and which still does, but would have been not something we would recognize particularly as meditation. It would be more like kind of mystical incantations, magical formulas, okay, attempts to get various kinds of psychic powers, ability to prophesize the future, all of these kinds of things. Yeah, so those kind of more kind of shamanic, magical things would be going on a lot. And the forest tradition was closely associated with that. Yeah, so the forest monks before Ajahn Mun's day was more like these kind of wild men of the woods, yeah, doing these kind of slightly kind of edgy, shamanic kind of stuff, yeah, maybe a bit of black magic thrown in the mix, you know, a bit like, you know, a bit not unlike the kind of the rishis and sadhus you get sometimes in India, yeah. And so it was Ajahn Mun's tradition that we established that as a Lavinia basis, yeah. The similarities would be that in what we would regard or call forest tradition these days, in Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka, they would all be similar in having a very strict approach to Vinaya and emphasizing the core meditation practices and living in the forest seclusion, those kinds of things. So in many ways, very similar, and typically. Certainly, as far as the Western monks are concerned, there's a lot of movement to and fro. So, you know, a lot of monks who I know are staying in Narwena or other forest monasteries in Sri Lanka, or would go to Pao or can stay in the forest monasteries in Myanmar. That happens all the time. Perhaps the main difference would be that the Sri Lankan and Burmese forest traditions, especially the Burmese and to a large degree the Sri Lankan, have more investment in a strict Theravada doctrinal orthodoxy. Yeah? Now that's not important to the Thai forest tradition at all. But certainly in the Burmese Pauk tradition, everything has to be right down the line according to the Pali commentaries and sub-commentaries, and he's very, very learned in those things and follows every detail of that. Sri Lankan forest tradition, depending on where you are, some monasteries are very much like that, others are a bit more independent thinking. But in the Thai forest tradition, Thai culture is very non-dogmatic culture, and they are very comfortable to reject things that are found in the commentaries or even to reject things that are found in the suttas. Ajahn Mahabua is quite happy to say, oh no, this sutta must be wrong because I know from my experience. Yeah? There's various teachings which they have in the Thai forest tradition, the most famous one being they talk about the original mind. Okay, so Ajahn Mahabua talks about the original mind. It's not a concept you find in the Pali canon. And so from a position of Theravadan orthodoxy, it's very questionable. So there are things like that which you do find in the Thai tradition. Yeah.
see transition from other.